Blog Talk Radio.
Well, your dad's gum government, you sorry so-and-sos. You got your damn hands in every pocket of my clothes. Well, your dad's gum, dad's gum. Government, you better pay attention. You're setting up there like a fool's convention. Where you get down, get down, get down, government.
Welcome to Handling the Truth. This is Terry Dodd. I'm here with my co-host tonight, Mike Gaddy, and we also have a special guest with us tonight that Mike will introduce here shortly. But I want to open us up right with a prayer before we get started, and we're going to be talking about one of Mike Gaddy's favorite people tonight, possibly his, well, I wouldn't say most favorite, because there's one other one I'm sure that may exceed all others, but maybe two. But let's start this with a prayer. Almighty Father, we come to you tonight, we come humbly, because we look around us and we see how out of control this world is, yet we know you still have control. And that that can be troubling for some people sometimes, because they wonder why you're not stepping in and doing something about all the evil that is happening around us in this world. But we know that in your prophecy, you've stated that people have to see this. They're going to have to witness this in order to understand why you'll bring it to a close and appreciate the victory that you're going to bring through your Son. Father, we just appreciate the fact that you give us an audience with you. We come before you covered in the righteousness of your Son, because that's the only way that we could come into your presence, because we know that that we do wrong every day. Our attitudes are not right. And Father, we just pray that we can be in your desire and do your will, and that what we do and say will be pleasing to you. We know that you created it all. You're the greatest scientist there is out there, because Who can know the science of it better than the one that created it? We know that you sustain us, and that everything we experience is because you are sustaining us. We know that that which is good is that only that which will sustain us, and you are it. That's why your Son said, only the Father is good. Father, be with us tonight, be with our listeners, be with our guest. Strengthen us, give us courage, and give us wisdom, and help us bring the truth forward here on Handling the Truth. It's in the name of Yahshua HaMashiach we pray. Amen. Well,
amen.
Mike Gaddy, how you doing, bud?
Hey, I'm doing pretty good. I just tried to call our guest, and I got no answer, Terry, so I sure hope he's okay. But anyway, oh, wow, fantastic. No wonder he wouldn't answer the phone.
Look at your Skype screen.
Oh, well, I'm not on Skype. I'm on standard phone tonight. Hey, Greg, how you doing, buddy?
Pretty good. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you okay.
Hear you.
Okay. All right. I didn't know if I had to unmute or anything. Yeah, looking forward to this.
Well, you
tell
guys
us about
are
your
both.
Guest,
oh well, Greg is just one of the most intelligent guys I've met. He is constantly thinking. I used to love to have him in my Constitution classes back in Colorado, because he always came up with great lead-in questions and always had one of those inquiring minds, not the one you see on the rack at the supermarket, but he had a very inquiring mind as to constitutional issues and to history. So, Greg, it's really super to have you on, buddy. Haven't seen you in 4 years, but it sure is great to have you on.
I'm humbled by that introduction. Well, I'm speechless at the moment.
Okay.
I'm looking forward to adding my two cents to your conversation tonight.
All right. Well, let me kick us off here, and here's one of the things that I have wondered about throughout my lifetime, especially the last 30 years of really getting into the history of this country. And to look at this, the man we're going to talk about tonight, who is one of my favorites, and that would be Patrick Henry. And to look at his importance in our history and how he has been forgotten in a great deal of our history, because I believe that if we look back at accurate history, we'll find out in 1765, a young attorney in Virginia showed up at the Virginia House of Burgesses, and he showed up in homespun clothes. And at first, when he got there, no one thought that he should be there because he wasn't wearing the powdered wigs and all the other fancy stuff and of the House of Burgesses. And he was questioned about his credentials. And so when he provided his credentials for being elected to the House of Burgesses, happened to be on his 28th birthday, if I'm not mistaken. He was told very upfront that as a new member of the House of Burgesses, you normally just sit and listen and learn. Well, that wasn't in Patrick Henry's DNA. So they get into the discussion on the Stamp Act. And the Stamp Act is being implemented. It has it's going to take effect. This is in May. The Stamp Act is going to take effect that winter or the first of the next year in 1766. So they're talking about how they're going to implement it and all these other things. And so Patrick Henry stands up and begins to launch into an attack on King George for bringing taxation like this to the people of the colonies. And so the older members, including Edmund Randolph and several others who were there, the aristocracy, the wealthy aristocracy of Virginia, they immediately start saying treason, treason. And that is when Patrick Henry said, well, if this be treason, let's make the most of it. And so the proposals against the Stamp Act that Patrick Henry brought out, even though he was opposed by the leadership of the Virginia House of Burgesses, caught on, and within a week or two were being read in Boston, Massachusetts by none other than Samuel Adams. So to if you want to talk about the ignition point of the revolution in the colonies, it had to be Patrick Henry. There's no way of denying that. And then, of course, there's his famous speech at St. John's Church, which he ended with, give me liberty or give me death. And I think that was pretty well epitomizes Patrick Henry. But we look at Patrick Henry and we study him in school and the give me liberty or give me death speech. But then there are certain charlatans out there who have a group called Wall Builders, who often talk about the Christian element within our founders. Well, Patrick Henry was without a doubt the most devout Christian among the founders. And the reason I say that is because that's what they said. That was in their letters amongst themselves. They said that themselves about Patrick Henry. So that is not just my opinion. That was the opinion of his peers. So he opposed the Constitutional Convention, was asked to go as a delegate, and said he could not because he smelled a rat leaning toward a monarchy in Philadelphia, and he would not attend. And then no one fought harder against the Constitution and the ratification of the Constitution than did Patrick Henry. The one thing that has always troubled me is as we look back through our history, we talk about founders, and very seldom is Patrick Henry ever mentioned. They mention Madison, Washington, Hamilton, and many others as they go through the list. But when they went to the Constitutional Convention, the thing that Americans seem to forget is that the men who wrote and put together the Constitution and signed it in September 17th of 1787, did not want a Bill of Rights. They did not want rights into the Constitution. They did not want rights in their Constitution. They did not want the people's rights listed. And that should be a dire warning for all of us. Everyone should think about that. Why would these men not want the people to have a Bill of Rights? Because the Bill of Rights was central in every state at that time. All 13 states, their Bill of Rights was very central to them. So why would a group of people together and write a constitution that was all about government and growing government and making bigger and making government more powerful and totally leave the people's rights sitting on totally out? And they did vote about a Bill of Rights because George Mason brought it up, and they had a vote, and it was voted down by states. It was voted down unanimously. So they did not want a Bill of Rights. Pardon me. So later during the ratification fights, James Wilson of Pennsylvania, when he was asked at the Pennsylvania Ratification Convention why they didn't want a Bill of Rights, James Wilson said, well, you know, all of the states have their individual Bill of Rights, so a Bill of Rights in the central government was superfluous. There was no reason to have one, and that sounds like a great argument until you understand and read Luther Martin, who was the Attorney General of the state of Maryland, who was at the Constitutional Convention, and then you his answer to that in the state of Maryland was, well, no, because the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution and the Necessary and Proper Clause of the Constitution and the General Welfare Clause of the Constitution wipes out and supersedes any state constitution. People had no rights. And if it hadn't have been for the Anti-Federalists, if it hadn't have been for people like Patrick Henry and those who followed behind him, there would have been no Bill of Rights into the added to the Constitution. It wouldn't have been there. The people would have had zero rights. If we think we have it tough today, of course, the Bill of Rights didn't slow them down very much, still doesn't. But the wording, if we look at the Federalist Papers, and they're all talking about power, and where do we put this power, and where do we put that power, and why do we need powers in government? But if you look at the words of Patrick Henry, you have exactly the opposite. You know, and one of the things that I love about him is especially on June the 5th when he made this statement. And he said, "You are not to inquire how your trade may be increased, nor how you are to become a great and powerful people, but how your liberties can be secured, for liberty ought to be the direct end of your government." Well, you know, that, according to our Declaration of Independence, is the primary function of government, is to protect the people's rights. That's why governments were instituted among men. And so we have a complete split here. And Patrick Henry fought this very diligently in the Virginia Ratification Convention, and he fought it in ways that we are unaware of, you know, that we aren't taught in history. Was that when we look at the first Senate of the first Congress of the United States, there were 20 Federalists elected to the Senate and only two Anti-Federalists. Well, those two Anti-Federalists came from the state of Virginia because of the efforts of Patrick Henry. Patrick Henry worked very diligently to make sure that at least Virginia had some anti-federalists in that first Congress, and the two that he got elected were Richard Henry Lee and William Grayson. And Grayson was a colonel in the Revolutionary Army. So he got those two men elected. Of course, James Madison said that he wasn't seeking a Senate seat in Virginia, but he was. And he lost. And so then Madison had to come running back to Virginia from New York, where he was up there writing the Federalist Papers. He had to come back to Virginia and run for Congress. And Patrick Henry did everything he could, even doing a little gerrymandering of election districts, to try to keep James Madison out of the first Congress. And unfortunately, that didn't work. But there's a great trivia question for you. The only election in U.S. history where two future presidents ran against each other, James Madison defeated James Monroe. So any thoughts so far, gentlemen?
Well, I just want to welcome Greg to the show. Thank you. Welcome to Handling the Truth, Greg.
Thanks, Terry. I believe that you're a fellow Coloradan. I'm over here on the West Slope, down in Southwest Colorado. I'm listening to this whole thing and following, you know, the whole line of this creation of this national government, and I wonder if it wasn't their intent to begin with to set this up as a corporation so that, you know, that there's that corporate aspect of our government today.
Well, you know, I think that very well may have been a part of their goal. But they didn't officially call it a corporation. Of course, now, if we take our preamble, we have we the people of the United States, and we'll get into Patrick Henry's attack on that. But it says, we the people of the United States, go down into the preamble, and then it says, establish this Constitution for the people of the United States of America. So there are two separate entities in the preamble. We the people of the United States, well, according to 28 U.S.C. 3002.15a, the United States is a corporation. Of course, that was not established in 1787, but I think you're exactly right, Greg.
It takes people like us to one of the things that has always stuck in my head from those classes that I miss over there in Cortez was that I believe one time in our spirited discussion, this whole thing of liberty is actually something that's in your DNA. You either have it or you don't. And if you have it, it's impossible not to stand up and demand it and to do everything to bring it to other people's attention when they're treading on you.
Well, I'm trying to think of the Greg. Exact quote, Greg, but I there is a quote, and I passed that out to my study group on Facebook. There was actually a statement to that effect, that people who have this in our DNA, who have this this thirst for liberty, and hopefully it came from people like Patrick Henry. And there is a part of that quote, and I wish I had it memorized, but it says that we who have this type of emotion, this type of feeling, if liberty didn't exist, we'd create it. And so I think that's exactly right, Greg. I think you either have this quest to be free, and of course did a show last week on Isaiah and the Remnant on my Sunday evening show. And that is exactly it. The remnant are those people with this undying, unquenchable thirst for liberty, and they're going to fight for liberty, and they care not for what the masses care for, and what the masses care for is comfortable lies.
And that,
Greg, to follow up on your...
Go ahead.
To follow up on your initial statement or suspicion about the corporate structure. It was stated, and Mike, you can refresh my memory on who actually made the comment. I think it was either might have been Madison that admitted that they really wanted to for the states to be subordinate to the federal government. And when they didn't completely accomplish that with this initial constitution, it's a natural progression to incorporate the states and have them basically be a subordinate corporation to the main corporation. And that, so there was a natural progression to that, that I don't think it was their initial intent to do the corporations, but that became a way of facilitating having the central government be, in essence, superior to the corporate states.
What is it? Yeah. Article 6, Clause 2, Clause 3?
Clause
2. Clause 2? Yep.
Yeah, the Supremacy Clause. Article 6, Clause 1 was installed into the Constitution to protect Robert Morris and the original First Bank, the Bank of North America. That clause was established there because Clause 1 stipulates that only the debts against the United States are to be paid. It mentions nothing about the debts that are owed to the United States, which Morris and his cohorts, his fellow bankers, owed the federal government into the millions of dollars. And as soon as the Constitution was ratified with Article 6, Clause 1, all of those debts were forgiven.
Poof. Up in smoke.
Yeah, they were suddenly gone. And although today there was another clause that the Federalists put in there to protect their original first banksters. Another clause that was put in there was the ex post facto law, which today we think that's a wonderful law. But also with the ratification of the Constitution, none of these banksters during the war who made millions of dollars off of the Revolutionary War, none of them could be charged with embezzlement or fraud or anything else because of the no ex post facto law.
Where did all the other protection that has, you know, what is the foundation for the government protecting itself that we find ourselves in today? Because it's the, in our case over here, over the initiatives back in 2014, we were kind of warned about it ahead of time, but literally the Attorney General and the whole Bar Association judicial system under it did everything to protect all government employees involved.
Well, that's a natural tendency, and the natural evolution of government is originated to protect the people from elements within society that are criminal. And as government evolves, government ends up protecting itself from everyone. And that is exactly what you encountered in 2014.
Okay. Well, let's move on with Patrick.
And now they've also protected Big Pharma.
Well, naturally, because Big Pharma, look how much money they put out there, Terry. They're one of the largest contributors out there, and probably Big Pharma owns probably more members of Congress than the mob does.
I got
no
a question.
Doubt.
I got
Go
a
ahead.
Question. So when government takes over business, that's communism, isn't it? And when
well,
business,
actually, it's fascism.
Oh, I thought when business, I thought business taking over government was fascism, and let me
well,
see if I
when
got
they
this.
Combine.
Well, what do you call it when healthcare takes over government or government takes over healthcare?
Treason.
Because we have a very, to me, we've got a problem that is growing exponentially, and that is this triad of banking, government, and healthcare being locked together.
Greg,
go ahead.
Greg, I've said repeatedly, and I wasn't the first to say it. There's been a couple of others, including Red Beckman, who said it before me. But when the government gave the banksters control of the money supply, the banksters became more powerful than the government. And the banksters are the principal controlling interest in big pharma, big agriculture now, so many other industries. They've taken control of it because of their ability to steal the production and wealth of the people. So they own it all, and they own it all by means of a toxic currency. And there's actually a book out there by that name. And I think Mike, you may know Ron McDonald that wrote that.
Yes, I do. Well, see, this is the thing that if you really understand the history under once that the 1776, once we started in seeking our liberty and our separation from Great Britain, that part of history is so very, very critical to understanding, and most people do not have a clue. And what happened during that time frame. So we came up with our first Continental Congress, comes up with the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union. Well, there's some great things about those Articles of Confederation. And number one is it had no executive, because at that time frame, we did not want an executive in this country, because we had just fought a war to get rid of an executive running the government, running a centralized government. So they had fought a war to make sure they didn't have one, so they didn't want one in their government. And they, at that time, all of the individual states felt like that their state judicial systems were competent to handle any issue that arose within those states, so they didn't feel like they needed a centralized judicial system, which they felt like would overwhelm the states, which it certainly did. So they were right about that. The only thing that they wanted in the Articles of Confederation, the only thing they wanted was a Congress. And they had some very tough stipulations in those Articles of Confederation. Number one, everyone was elected for a one-year term. And your state could have up to 7 representatives sent to Congress if they wanted that many, but regardless of how many you sent, your state only had 1 vote. So those 7 would have to decide, or if you sent 3 people or how many ever, they had to make a decision on what legislation they supported. The second part was they had term limits. No one could serve more than 3 years out of any 6. Another great advantage to the Articles of Confederation was immediate recall. If you campaigned and told people, hey, if you elect me, I'll do 1, 2, 3, and you went to, Philadelphia, Washington, or New York, wherever Congress happened to be meeting, and you went there and you did 9, 10, and 11, your people back in your state could say, hey, you lied. Come on back home. We'll send somebody else. So, and then the thing that ended up being the critical part was Article 13, which meant that for any law to pass the legislature, it had to be approved by all 13 states. Well, in 1781, the Articles of Confederation was finally ratified. And it was ratified, the last state to ratify it, which was the 13th state, was Maryland. And Maryland ratified it because they were afraid of incursions into Maryland by the Redcoats. So they finally ratified it in 1781. So then it became the law of the land. But there was a war going on, so they appointed a financier for the government who was Robert Morris. So Robert Morris basically becomes a dictator. He gets all of the dictatorial powers because there's a war going on, which we've been warned about. Under a war, the people's liberties go out the window. Well, it certainly happened even under the Articles of Confederation. But the problem was is that even with what Robert Morris was doing, and he started the first bank, which was the Bank of North America, and he started that, and he one of the first things he did was he basically embezzled out of the federal government. At that time, they had a $470,000 loan from France. And so he embezzles $200,000+ out of that and starts the first bank along with $70,000 that he collects. But who does he make his first loans to? Out of the Bank of North America, he loans money to his cohorts, to his financial buddies, so they can buy stock in the bank, so that then when he loans money to the U.S. government and it's paid with tax money, then all of his cronies get the money off of the interest off of those loans when he loaned them the money to buy the stock. So that was the corruption of the bank. So if you want to look at when the banksters first took over, and I firmly believe that Robert Morris patterned all of this because he had many visits to England, and I believe that he patterned all this after the Bank of England. So I'm not even positive that the Bank of England wasn't somehow involved in this deal, except the money, your first money. So he sets up fractional reserve banking, and he starts loaning out much more money than they had, which is exactly the same thing we're dealing with now. So the money was being loaned, but his cronies were getting all of the interest off of the money that was created out of nothing. So that is the reason Article 6, Clause 1 was put into the Constitution to protect these people, and many of Robert Morris's friends were at the Constitutional Convention. Livingston, James Wilson, Alexander Hamilton, Gouverneur Morris, all of these people were there who had benefited off of this first bank, and they're the ones who owed the money to the U.S., so naturally they're going to put in Article 6, Clause 1. I'm babbling on and on, guys. Somebody throw something in here.
Well, what you're covering right there sounds like all the attorneys that we have in Congress now at federal, state level, and for some reason they're always able to cover their tracks and protect their friends. And so I'm curious of that little group that you referred to in the original convention, how many of those were actually attorneys?
Well, that is a great question, Greg. And the percentage of attorneys in the population itself was probably 0.00. I figured this out one time. If you figured out how many million people were around about that time, 9 million folks. If you look at that and you figure the population of attorneys, the percentage of attorneys was like 0.004% of the population was attorneys. Yet at the Constitutional Convention, 48% of the people at the Constitutional Convention were attorneys.
Go. That's why we have what we have today.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, my friend. I can't remember the exact quote, but I know Thomas Jefferson said it. And he said, one of the things that is so amazing is that how can you expect to put this many lawyers together? And Jefferson was a lawyer. But he said, how in a legislature, how in a Congress can you ever get to ever expect to get anything done when you put 50 lawyers into it and when they are paid to write things and talk? So how do you ever expect to get anything done? Now, he said it much more eloquently than I did, but even Jefferson saw through that problem.
There you go.
So, you know, again, to get back to good old Patrick Henry, the questions that he asked, gentlemen, are just, you know, that makes so much sense, and yet we look more to James Madison, and it was James Madison who said that in a letter to Edmund Randolph in April of 1787, just a month, maybe it was March, a month or two before the Constitutional Convention, Terry, he's the one who told Edmund Randolph that they wanted to get to Philadelphia and eliminate the states as far as government was concerned, except in instances where they might be subordinately useful.
Yep,
so you were
that was
you
the
were,
one.
You were correct. You were correct. It was Madison. But some of the questions, again, that Patrick Henry asked, he said, is it necessary for your liberty that you should abandon those great rights by adopting this system, which he was talking about the Constitution? And he said, again, will the abandonment of your most sacred rights tend to the security of your liberty? Liberty, the greatest of all earthly blessings. Give us that precious jewel, and you may take everything else. But I am fearful. I have lived long enough to become a fellow. Perhaps an invincible attachment to the dearest rights of men may, in these refined, enlightened days, be deemed old-fashioned. If so, I am content to be so. I say the time has been when every pore of my heart beat for American liberty, and which I believe had a counterpart in the breast of every true American. So there we go back to that spirit, Greg. Again, you either have it or you don't. And then again, I'll jump to another quote by good old Patrick. He said, guard with jealous attention the public liberty. Suspect everyone who approaches that jewel. Unfortunately, nothing will preserve it but downright force. Whenever you give up that force, you are inevitably ruined. And we gave it up ratifying the Constitution in 1788. My opinion, I sell it for what it's worth.
Well, I think it's just as true today as it was then. It's amazing these days with all of this unilateral control of everything by these governments and all of their minions that are willing to, you know, I find it funny that here in Colorado, Polis was able to close churches and keep pot shops and liquor stores open.
Well, Greg, I would challenge that. Polis might have said to do that. The people allowed it to happen.
I agree.
So
I agree. And I've said that.
Go ahead.
I've said that from the beginning, that everybody did this to themselves. Every business that's going under and everybody wearing masks, this whole thing, people have done it to themselves.
Well, I, for one, would never darken the door of any church that allowed the government to close it down.
Kind of makes you wonder what they're preaching the rest of the time.
Well, I think if we go back, I forgot who the evangelist was in the 1800s. I was trying to think of his name, but he said, if you find a problem in society, you will find its origin in the pulpit. So
I think that is exactly true as well. Here again from Patrick Henry, he says, but we are told that we need not fear, because those in power, being our representatives, will not abuse the power we put in their hands. He said, I am not well versed in history, but I will submit to your recollection whether liberty has been destroyed most often by the licentiousness of the people or by the tyranny of the rulers. I imagine, sir, you will find the balance on the side of tyranny. Happy will you be if you miss the fate of those nations who, omitting to resist their oppressors or negligently suffering their liberty to be wrested from them, have groaned under intolerable despotism. Is this not exactly what we're talking about? Most of the human race are now in this deplorable condition, and those nations who have gone in search of grandeur, power, and splendor have also fallen a sacrifice and have been the victims of their own folly. While they acquired those visionary blessings, they lost their freedom. My great objection to this government is that it does not leave us the means of defending our rights or of waging war against tyrants. You know, this is poetry. I mean, and it's history. This man is just laying it out there. And again, this is so relevant to today, and that's why I wanted to do this subject. And he said, it is urged by some gentlemen that this new plan will bring us an acquisition of strength, an army, and the militia of the states. This is an idea extremely ridiculous. Gentlemen cannot be earnest. This acquisition will trample on our fallen liberty. Let my beloved Americans guard against that fatal lethargy that has pervaded this universe. Have we the means of resisting disciplined armies when our only defense, our militia, is put into the hands of Congress? And he's speaking about the honorable gentleman here who was Edmund Randolph at that time. He says, the honorable gentleman said that great danger would ensue if the convention rose without adopting this system. I ask, where is that danger? I see none. Other gentlemen have told us that within these walls that the Union is gone or that the Union will be gone. Is not this trifling with the judgment of your fellow citizens? Till they tell us the grounds of their fears, I will consider them as imaginary. I rose to make inquiry where those dangers were. They could make no answer. I believe I shall never have that answer. Is there a disposition in the people of this country to revolt against the dominion of laws? Has there been a single tumult in Virginia? Have not the people of Virginia, when laboring under the severest pressure of accumulated distresses, manifested the most cordial acquiescence in the executions of the laws? Exactly what we're doing right now.
I'm amazed at how they don't mince words there.
No, Patrick Henry didn't mince any words. I'll promise you, you got it straight from the barrel. And he says, what could be more awful than their unanimous acquiescence under general distresses? Oh, my God. That is exactly what we're going through. What could be more awful than their unanimous acquiescence under general distresses? Virus, people. Goodness. I'm sorry. I get rather passionate reading my friend Patrick Henry. You guys jump on it there for a while.
Well, I keep hearing talking heads basically supporting the narrative that what is causing all of these symptoms is in fact a virus. I believe that the first question we need to ask right now is what's really causing these symptoms, because they have not isolated a virus. They have not proven that it is a virus causing these symptoms. Anyone who says otherwise is simply lying. We really need to start asking questions and get people understanding that what you are fearing is simply a narrative and not real science, which exposes the whole thing.
Well, I agree totally.
Any comment
to
that?
And
Well, Terry, I can't but agree with you, because I believed from late February that this was a fraud. And any time that you can get the people to, and they knew the masses were going to do this. I mean, hell, guys, the masses of the people in this country believe the laws of physics went away on September 11th, 2001. The laws of physics no longer pertain. The government was able to take the law of physics away and cause three buildings to crash into their own footprint from forces that were impossible to create that, especially building number 7, which collapsed into its own footprint and nothing hit it.
So my analogy is take a piece of concrete, throw it up in the air and see if it turns into powder before it hits the ground. Because those buildings were being turned into powder in midair. That gravity doesn't do that.
Go ahead.
I've felt that as soon as pandemic was called on, that was March 11th, I believe, and March 13th is when the proverbial manure hit the fan and shelves started emptying out at the stores. And I don't know how much of the supply chain was actually set up in the beginning for some of this stuff to continue to happen, because I know factories and things hadn't been shut down yet. But, what happened to common sense? And, childhood stories like Chicken Little and the sky is falling, that's how I see most people that are running around with masks. When you actually talk to them, the two main responses that I've gotten have been that they don't want to be hassled, and they don't want to offend somebody else. And my first response back to that is always, but real bugs, they don't care about offending anybody. I'm kind of a practical kind of guy. I try to connect dots, and I don't see people. I don't see all kinds of people being sick. When this was supposed to be like at its peak, and I had heard some stories about, empty ambulances sitting around hospitals, and I actually watched a YouTube where this guy was actually walking around the hospital with his smartphone, and he was videoing, and he was trying to find out what was going on. A security guy from the hospital came out and kind of confronted him about what he was doing, and then another hospital official started following that guy around and was just trying to get him to go away. I immediately called the regional hospital over in Durango, and I was just being, I think at that time, they were suggesting that you call a hospital before you come in. And I heard all kinds of stories about, hospitals not wanting people to come to the hospital. So the initial receptionist I asked, I said, "Are you guys busy?" And she said, "No, oh no." And I went, "Really, would you connect me with the ER? And so the nurse on the desk in the ER, same thing. I'm first in a very friendly tone, asked how busy they were, and they weren't. And I go, "Wow, even with this whole virus and pandemic thing going on, huh?" And she goes, "Oh, we can't talk about that." And it was interesting that comment in itself was exactly a comment that this guy on YouTube, who was around some hospital in New York, That was, I believe it was the security. I can't remember now if it was a security guy or like the administrator from the hospital that was following him around. But he asked, and they that was what they told him was, oh, we can't talk about that. So this whole thing, to me, it was bogus just because I went ahead and did a little checking on my own, and sure enough, there's no pandemic going on. There's not this mass sickness going on, and yet the media is hyping all this stuff up, and I think everybody really bought into the whole Chicken Little story. The sky is falling, and they were telling each other the sky is falling, even though if they would have looked up, they would have saw the sky wasn't falling. And that seems to be the world that we're kind of stuck in at the moment.
Well, a lot of that was facilitated back years ago when we came up with 24-hour news, because we learned from Joseph Goebbels that if you repeat something over and over and over and over for 24 hours, even if people aren't really paying attention, the phrases repeated over and over become truth in their minds because they hear them so many times. And that is part of a propaganda move. And as soon as they came up with 24-hour news instead of 15 minutes like it used to be when I was a kid, people, if you go into a restaurant or something else, in these days, all they have on is CNN. So you hear the same repetitive propaganda over and over and over. It's a psyop. It's a classic psyop. If people don't know what a psychological operation is, read up on Goebbels and see what he did in Nazi Germany. We're experiencing exactly the same thing.
I agree. This is, so is the government enforcing media, or is media using the government to force their agenda?
The government took over the media with Operation Mockingbird, and they admitted it, the CIA admitted it on several occasions. And if you go back to 1981 and William Casey, and Ronald Reagan's first staff meeting, he said, "We will know that our disinformation program is complete when everything the American public believes is a lie." And that is verifiable. So if he said it in 1981, what makes us think they weren't serious? Was that a joke?
Well, I've actually read that.
Well, let's...
How long is it going to take you to present Patrick Henry's speech at the ratification? Yeah.
Oh, if I did all of his speeches at ratification with comments, about 3.5 weeks. But anyway, I'll jump into it again. Here's part of that June the 5th. He said, "The honorable gentleman who presides told us that to prevent abuses in our government, we will assemble in convention, recall our delegated powers, and punish our servants for abusing the trust reposed in them." Oh, sir, we should have fine times indeed if to punish tyrants it were only sufficient to assemble the people. Your arms wherewith you could defend yourselves are gone, and you have no longer an aristocratical, no longer democratical spirit. Did you ever read of any revolution in a nation brought about by the punishment of those in power inflicted by those who had no power at all? Let that one ring in your head for a while. He also said, "A standing army we shall have also to execute the inexorable commands of tyranny. And how are you to punish them? Will you order them to be punished? Who shall obey these orders? Will your mace bearer be a match for a disciplined regiment?" Now, of course, in those days, he said, you have a standing army. Today, we have a standing army that is not necessarily the military.
how many federal law enforcement officers with all the different bureaus do you think you have? And how many state and local officials will tell you that if the federal government says do it, they have no other choice but to do it? We have it all over the country. So listen to this and think about those people in uniforms, whether it be federal or even the ones in three-piece suits that are FBI or BATF or any of the IRS or any of those other federal alphabet agencies. Think of this again. A standing army we shall have also to execute the inexorable commands of tyranny. And how are you to punish them? Will you order them to be punished? Who shall obey your orders? Will your mace bearer be a match for a disciplined regiment? Is anyone a match today for a SWAT team that shows up at your house? I think we already have
Mike,
the answers to that.
I won't put you. I don't want to put you on the spot. So
please
also
do
make a statement, and you can attack it if you wish. The CIA has its own military force.
Well, that is, you know, and they do it with what we call black money, and it's not on the books, and it's usually with the CIA, as we used to refer to them as Christians in Action. It's usually that group that has realized most of their operational money off the international drug trade. And that was a bumper sticker I used to have on my pickup truck. Said, dare to keep the CIA off drugs. So they use this money, and they use it, and they buy off their influence. They have influence almost everywhere. And so they have their own army, but I promise you, and I've heard, you know, that wonderful sheriff they elected in Montezuma County at a when he was running for sheriff back in 14, he made the wonderful statement. Somebody asked him, says, well, what if the federal government tells you that you have to go around the county confiscating everybody's guns? He said, I'll have to do it. I have no other choice. And they elected the bastard. So, you know, I think it was Thomas Jefferson said, you get the government you deserve. So that's that is exactly these people, when their incomes depend on it, when they've got their pensions and everything else laid out, when the government comes up with an unconstitutional law, 95% of these people are going to enforce it. Now, you may say, no, they won't, but I promise you they will. Look at the red flag laws. Do we have a Second Amendment? How many people have already been killed by cops who show up with a SWAT team to confiscate somebody's weapons who has done nothing? You know, that poor girl in Maryland, one of the first ones, a poor girl in school had been told over and over in school, I think she was 7th or 8th grade, had been told how terrible guns were and that people shouldn't own, private people shouldn't own firearms. They're for the government. And she had heard this in school, and she knew that her grandfather, uncle, or some member of her family had firearms, and she was terribly, terribly worried about it. So she made a phone call to the police. And so because Maryland has red flag laws, they go out there because even his family thinks he's dangerous. They go to his house. He comes outside and says, no, you're not getting my guns. And they shot him and killed him. And we have a Second Amendment. Will somebody tell me how the Second Amendment helped that guy? Would someone tell me how those people who showed up at his house armed, a whole SWAT team to take in one man, has anyone, did they take an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution? I don't understand how people keep saying, oh, well, no, they won't do that. I heard that forever during the 60s and 70s when you would ask people, what happens when they come for your guns? Oh, that'll never happen here. Well, guess what? It's here.
All you got to do is put their paycheck on the line. They're I generally try to correct people when they make a comment about the government is doing this or the government is doing that. The government can't do anything because it's just books and papers and policy and procedures. What we have is a bunch of government employees, and when a government employee's paycheck is on the line, they're not going to pay any attention to the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution. They may not even pay any attention to whatever policies and procedures that whatever department they're part of. They're going to do whatever their superior told them to, because it's going to, their paycheck is going to be on the line.
Well, guys, in the 1980s, if this country had, well, number one, the first thing in 1973 when they passed Roe v. Wade, the country should have gone to Washington and thrown the people out from that point. But in the 1980s, when the Supreme Court said that government employees have qualified immunity, once that was passed, we were done. Because that says that any government official in the performance of his duties, even when he commits a crime, he or she, they cannot be held liable for it. Prosecutors cannot be sued for sending people to prison on trumped up charges. Even when that happens, they can't be sued because they did it. Even if they knew that what they were doing was wrong, they can't be sued. When you put those people above the law with qualified immunity, we're toast. There is no recovery. It's just wait and see how it ends, guys. That's where we are.
That's been our experience here. It's kind of amazing. Even sitting down, we had private meetings with the DA. We had to push and push and push. We've actually sat down with the sheriff and presented actual criminal stuff, what statutes actually say, what the Constitution says, what, like, the county commissioners and county attorney did. And right away, they, in the meeting with the sheriff, they were like, well, it looks like you have evidence of fraud here, and fraud's a felony. And it's a felony with no statute of limitations. We couldn't get the DA to do anything. When the DA actually sat down with us, the first thing he called us were a bunch of constitutionalists.
Yeah.
And we had to push and push and push to try and get some kind of an investigation done by the Attorney General. And it went nowhere. And when we finally got a meeting with their quote, investigators, it was a phone conference, and when they found out that it was being recorded, they refused to talk. They weren't even going to hold the meeting if we were going to record this, because reasonable people don't need to record a conversation. That was I think he's a lead investigator or prosecutor for the Attorney General's office. I believe his last name is Shapiro. That was pretty much what he had to say. They wouldn't talk to us if we were going to record the conversation.
Well,
so,
but if they call you in, they record everything you say.
Everything you say can and will be used against you.
Well, let me jump back to Patrick Henry here so I can get fired up again. Again, from the same speech, when the American spirit was in its youth, the language of America was different. Liberty, sir, was then the primary object. We are descended from a people whose government was founded on liberty. But now, sir, the American spirit, assisted by the ropes and chains of consolidation, is about to convert this country to a powerful and mighty empire. If you make the citizens of this country agree to become the subjects of one great consolidated empire of America, your government will not have sufficient energy to keep them together.
such a government is incompatible with the genius of republicanism. There will be no checks, no real balances in this government. What can avail your specious imaginary balances, your rope dancing, chain rattling, ridiculous ideal checks and contrivances? Amen, Patrick. This man, oh, he was a visionary. It's just absolutely incredible the things that he came up with. Terry, you're being awful quiet.
I've been muted because I have had a lot of noise behind me and I didn't want it to interfere.
Oh, okay. Well, it's just absolutely incredible when we talk about Patrick Henry. People, if you talk about, it's amazing to me that people will talk about being free. You know, it's in our Star-Spangled Banana. Land of the free and home of the brave. Well, if there was ever a joke played on the American public, there it is, because we certainly are not the land of the free, and we absolutely are not the home of the brave. Brave people don't wear masks because the government tells them to.
It's more like the land of the free and the home of the slave.
Yeah, well, that's a pretty good rendition. I promise you that. No doubt about that whatsoever, my friend. That is absolutely true. So now I'm kind of jumping to the June the 4th speech by Patrick Henry. And he says, "The public mind, as well as my own, is extremely uneasy at the proposed change of government. Give me leave to form one of the number of those who wish to be thoroughly acquainted with the reasons of this perilous and uneasy situation, and why are we brought hither to decide on this great national question. I consider myself as the servant of the people of this commonwealth." Now, you didn't hear any Federalists say that. "I consider myself as a servant of the people of the Commonwealth, as a sentinel over their rights, liberty, and happiness. I represent their feelings when I say that they are exceedingly uneasy being brought from that state of full security which they enjoyed to the present delusive appearance of things. A year ago, the mind of our citizens were at perfect repose. Before the meeting of the late Federal Convention at Philadelphia, a general peace and a universal tranquility prevailed in this country. But since that period, they are exceedingly uneasy and disquieted. When I wished for an appointment to this convention," he was talking about the ratification convention, "my mind was extremely agitated for the situation of public affairs. I conceive the republic to be in extreme danger. If our situation be thus uneasy, whence has arisen this fearful jeopardy? It arises from this fatal system. It arises from a proposal to change our government, a proposal that goes to the utter annihilation of the most solemn engagements of the states, a proposal of establishing 9 states into a confederacy to the eventual exclusion of 4, possible exclusion of 4. It goes to, and he goes into great detail about what this new constitution is going to destroy. Yet today there are people who will absolutely quit speaking to you totally if you disagree with the fact that this Constitution was inspired by God. We are dealing with a group of insanely indoctrinated cowards in this country. There's no other word for it."
I find it interesting that he says so much in so few words, yet he can still talk so long. I think he made it easy on these attorneys. I think he made it easy on these lawyers to ignore him because they weren't quite accustomed to hearing so much said in so few words.
Well, George Mason said he was spellbinding. Thomas Jefferson, who heard him in the Virginia House of Burgesses, Jefferson was a law student, a younger law student at the time. And Jefferson heard Patrick Henry give that presentation in the House of Burgesses, and he said he was spellbinding, that he had this people. They called him the voice of thunder. But, you were exactly right, Terry. It's the logic. And this is one of the parts that I like the best about his presentation. He said, "We the people, my political curiosity, exclusive my anxious solicitude for the public welfare, leads me to ask, who authorized them to speak the language of we the people instead of we the states? States are the characteristics and the soul of a confederation. If the states be not the agents of this compact, it must be one great consolidated national government of the people of all of the states. I have the highest respect for these gentlemen who formed the convention, and were some of them not here, I would express some testimonial of esteem for them. America had on a former occasion put the utmost confidence in them, a confidence which was well placed, and I am sure, sir, I would give up anything to them. I would cheerfully confide in them as my representatives, but, sir, on this great occasion, I would demand the cause of their conduct, even from that illustrious man who saved us by his valor." He's talking about Washington. "I would have a reason for his conduct. That liberty which he has given us by his valor tells me to ask this reason, and I am, and sure I am, were he here, he would give us that reason. But there are other gentlemen here who can give us this information. The people gave them no power to use their name. That they exceeded their power is perfectly clear. It is not mere curiosity that actuates me. I wish to hear the real, actual, existing danger which should lead us to take those steps so dangerous in my conception. Disorders have arisen in other parts of America, but here, sir, no danger, no insurrection or tumult has happened. Everything has been calm and tranquil. But notwithstanding this, we are wandering on the great ocean of human affairs. I see no landmark to guide us. We are running we know not whither. Difference in opinion has gone to a degree of inflammatory resentment in different parts of the country, which has been occasioned by this perilous innovation. The Federal Convention ought to have amended the old system. For this purpose alone, they were solely delegated. The object of their mission extended to no other consideration. You must therefore forgive the solicitation of one unworthy member to know what danger could have arisen under the present Confederation and what are the causes of this proposal to change our government." Wow. Sometimes when I read his words, guys, I'll be honest with you, I get chills. Comments, Greg?
He just laid it right out.
Couldn't make it any clearer. I'm mesmerized, by the ability to put thoughts and words together so eloquently.
But he was using a teleprompter.
Let me throw this one at you, and I love this one too. Now, this is from June the 7th. He said that government is no more than a choice among evils, is acknowledged by the most intelligent among mankind, and has been a standing maxim for ages. If it be demonstrated that the adoption of the new plan is a little or a trifling evil, then, sir, I acknowledge that adoption ought to follow. But, sir, if this be a truth, that its adoption may entail misery on the free people of this country, I then insist that rejection ought to follow. Gentlemen strongly urge its adoption will be a mighty benefit to us, but, sir, I am made of such incredulous materials that assertions and declarations do not satisfy me. I must be convinced, sir. I shall retain my infidelity on this subject till I see our liberties secured in a manner perfectly satisfactory to my understanding. Wow. So, he says, "Sir, it is the fortune of a free people not to be intimidated by imaginary dangers. Fear is the passion of slaves."
Oh, whoa, 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 whoa. We need to remember those words and use them every day. Every day we need to repeat those words.
Oh, I try to put them up on Facebook as often as I can. That is a quote.
Say it again, Mike. Read it again.
Sir, it is the fortune of a free people not to be intimidated by imaginary dangers. Fear is the passion of slaves.
There you go.
I gotta put that at the bottom of my signature on my emails.
Well, I would put it at the top of the page and the bottom both, buddy. I tell you what.
I'm amazed because we actually grew up in a time when that whole thing of the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. And
oh, wow, Greg, you must be an old guy. I'm only 31.
Yeah, we had conversations.
I couldn't help
about
myself
that.
There. I couldn't help myself there. Sorry, go ahead.
Hey, I got a gray hair or two. Well, just that whole concept has been turned on its ear, and it goes along with what you said, that the whole psyop of being able to repeatedly, you know, put it out there to the masses so that one day everything that people in this country believe to be true is all just a big pack of lies. And we're there. We're there.
Well, I couldn't agree more.
And fear. That's the crazy thing. I always thought I was just a pretty average person. Nothing special about me. I know that personally. I met my fear when I was like 13 years old. And it was kind of funny because I scared the crap out of myself, and I realized it. And then from that day on, there's a whole lot of things that I would do that other people wouldn't necessarily do. And I was actually told by somebody at one point that when I was younger, I scared people. And I think I still do. And I'm not doing anything to intimidate anybody. But just a couple years ago, I actually got to sit down in a restaurant with somebody that I went to school with, and it was his restaurant. And he told me that when we were kids that I scared him, and I was like, why? And he goes, well, because you're such a free spirit. We never knew what you were going to do. And it's like that's missing in most people. People are afraid to do anything. They're afraid. They're actually afraid to test the boundaries of what they can do themselves. I guess that's part of the reason why we're where we're at.
Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely. Let me throw this one at you by Patrick Henry. I know we're getting close on time. Let me throw one more, Greg. And this one was about Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1, which gave the Congress the power to tax, which was the first power they gave to gave to Congress. So obviously they were there for a reason. What was their very first power? But anyway, here's what Patrick Henry had to say to that. He said, the clause under consideration gives an unlimited and unbounded power of taxation. Suppose every delegate from Virginia opposes a law laying a tax, what will it avail? They are opposed by a majority. 11 members, he's talking about states, can destroy their efforts. Those feeble 10 cannot prevent the passing the most oppressive tax law. So that in direct opposition to the spirit and express language of your Declaration of Rights, you are taxed not by your own consent, but by people who have no connection with you.
And if you consider what he just said, he said that even if the people of your state resist a federal tax, but if they're outvoted in Congress by people who have no connection with you, you are still taxed by those people. So you do not have a direct representative for your taxes. And Patrick Henry pointed that out so beautifully.
We have that at the county level here. One of the things that actually supports, keeps the stock market in place is government bonds for government building projects. They're constantly building new buildings, new jails, new courthouses. Anyway, a couple years ago here, they wanted to build a new jail courthouse complex. Put it on the ballot, the people turned it down. They did not want the sales tax raise to pay for that. It was a year and a half, 2 years passed, they do it again. Turned it down. This new bunch of county commissioners, instead of, they went around the Tabor, Taxpayer Bill of Rights, and they decided to go ahead and build the new jail courthouse, and they used what they refer to as certificates of participation, which are nothing more than floating bonds to go ahead and do the construction project that they want to do, and it's our taxes, you know, that pay it and the interest on those bonds. And so they put it out to a vote, people turned it down twice, and they went ahead and did it anyway. So there you go.
Well, you won't be able to color me surprised. Let me read this one real quick. I know we're getting close. In the scheme of energetic government, the people will find two sets of tax gatherers, the state and the federal sheriffs. This, it seems to me, will produce such a dreadful oppression as the people cannot possibly bear. The federal sheriff may commit what oppression, make what distresses he pleases, and ruin you with impunity. For how are you to tie his hands? Have you any sufficiently decided means of preventing him from sucking your blood by speculations, commissions, and fees? Thus, thousands of your people will be most shamefully robbed. Our state sheriffs, those unfeeling bloodsuckers, have, under the watchful eye of our legislature, committed the most horrid and barbarous ravages on our people. So I needed to throw that one in after your comment, Greg.
You know, actually listening to this, what has actually changed? Because it sounds like what he was talking about then, it was already going on. And here we are, you know, a couple hundred years later, same stuff is still going on. Nothing's changed.
Well, but he predicted it so well. And he said, if these sheriffs, thus immediately under the eye of our state legislature and judiciary, have dared to commit these outrages, what would they have done if their masters had been in Philadelphia or New York? If they perpetrate the most unwarrantable outrage on your person or property, you cannot get redress on this side of Philadelphia or New York, and how can you get it there? If your domestic avocations could permit you to go thither, there you must appeal to judges sworn to support this Constitution, in opposition to that of any state, and who may also be inclined to favor their own officers. We've talked about that. When these harpies are aided by excisemen or tax gatherers, who may search at any time your houses and most secret recesses, will the people bear it? Yes, Patrick, they bear it daily with a mask on.
Yep. Well, I think
Greg,
that he was.
Greg,
prophetic. Was he actually being prophetic, or was he actually sharing experiences that had already taken place and they were only going to get worse?
He saw it in the monarchy that they had come from and they had just fought against. But what he was saying was that this is what we're facing in the future here, and it's exactly what they had been fighting against.
Yeah.
Well, he said, I know of no way of predicting the future but by the past.
There. That's exactly what I was saying. It was stuff that had already been gone on. He'd already experienced it, already seen it. And by putting that document in place, it was guaranteeing that what we have today was coming.
Well, let me finish up with this one. This Constitution is said to have beautiful features, but when I come to examine these features, sir, they appear to me to be horribly frightful. Among other deformities, it has an awful squinting. It squints towards a monarchy. And does not this raise indignation in the breast of every American? Your president may easily become king. Your Senate is so imperfectly constructed that your dearest rights may be sacrificed by what may be a small minority. And a very small minority may continue forever unchangeably this government, although horribly defective. What are your checks with this government?
How many people do we have? How many people are elected that are actually in Washington?
You're talking about, actually, if you want to talk about Congress, 535.
And they're telling 330 million people what to do?
Exactly.
There you go.
And they call it a majority.
Mike, I want to compliment Greg, because, you know, one of the things that I've missed about Red being around is that Red had a way of saying things that the average person could clearly understand, and I think Greg has that talent and ability. So that is an extreme compliment, Greg. So.
Well, I could not agree more, and Greg, to be compared, to be mentioned in the same sentence with Red Beckman is an honor, my friend, I promise you, of the highest degree.
Well, I guess thank you to you both. Like I said, I've never thought there was anything special about me. I just look at what's going on and I connect dots. I know that I guess that's a gift that I have, and let's see, I'm trying to think how many years ago it was that I first went to one of your classes, but I'm one of them people that swallowed the red pill back in the early 90s, and I've put on a few classes, informational get-togethers, and it's amazing that people know that something's not right.
Gentlemen, I hate to cut you short, but we are out of time. It's really been great, Greg. Thanks for coming on with us tonight. Mike, great lesson again, as usual. We will be back next Thursday at same time, 6 o'clock Mountain, 8 o'clock Eastern, for Handling the Truth. Good night, gentlemen.
Thank you, gentlemen.
If you want.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night, guys.
Blackfoot singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life, you're only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see. All your life, you're only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird, fly. Blackbird, fly. into the light of a dark black night. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You're only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird fly. Blackbird fly. Into the light of the dark black night. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Won't you take these sunken eyes and learn to see all your life? You're only waiting for this moment to be free. You're only waiting for this moment to be free. You were only waiting for this moment to be free.